This is an iHeart podcast.
Okay, let's have a talk. It's one of those talks that I almost feel like dad, right? Your kid's laying around too much, needs to get a job, and it's time to have a talk. No, you're not the kid in this situation, but the normies of America, they are the kids in this situation. You, me, we understand spending. We understand government spending. We understand why it's a problem. So first, let's just talk about the good news. Yes. Inflation, as of this moment, is going down. It's ticking closer to 2%, which is the goal of the Fed. It's at 2.4. It was at 2.6. The goal of the Federal Reserve is 2%. Now, you and I can sit and argue about that goal, which I don't particularly care for. I don't understand why you have it baked into the economic cake that my money has to lose 2% of its value every single year. Why can't you try to increase its value? Why can't you maintain it? But look, that's obviously that ship has sailed, so let's not even dig into that. Okay, we're trending in the right direction if we have to put a nice face on this thing. Okay, we got it. But I don't have to tell you that that hasn't fixed prices, that prices aren't fixed, that we're looking at over 20%. In the last decade, you, unlike your parents, unlike your grandparents and their grandparents, you have lived in a unique period in American history. It's not the only period that's been like this, but it's been relatively unique for a few generations. You've seen your standard of living go down. We here in the United States of America have gotten used to a really wonderful thing. It's a wonderful way to live where everything gets better with time. We just go up, 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 and everything kind of gets better. So you should be able to afford better things, different things than your parents could afford. Now, you've probably either said this yourself or you've heard others say it. You look around and you wonder, why don't I own a house already? My parents had a house by now. My parents had a house, a couple cars. Why is everything so expensive now? Why do things feel financially out of reach now? Well, a huge reason things are financially out of reach now is the value of the dollar has gone down, 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 and down. You have less buying power now than your parents did. This is a reality. But the important part of that is the why. And the why is the part that's difficult to tackle, difficult to wrap your arms around it, certainly difficult to handle the problem. The why is government spending. The United States government has decreased your standard of living. The United States government and its spending has made you poorer. And I know I'm a partisan, you're probably a partisan, whether you're a commie who hate watches or an anti-communist like me. Republicans are as guilty as Democrats. We spend way too much money. And given the fact that the United States government takes in inhuman amounts of money, for them to continue to spend way more than that is unbelievably ridiculous. But they do. Republicans and Democrats, doesn't matter who's president, doesn't matter who controls the Congress, it's trillion-dollar bill after trillion-dollar bill, huge deficits after huge deficits. And look, it was already bad pre-COVID, but what happened during COVID really ramped everything up into warp speed is what it did. We took a bad chest cold and we used it to justify spending at World War II levels. Do you understand what this country did during World War II? Just a brief little rewind on this. The United States of America, because wars are expensive, they are now, they were then, and they always have been and always will be. It's very, very expensive to outfit an army, to prepare your country for war, to prosecute a war. It's unbelievably expensive, buying the bombs and the bullets and the medical stuff and paying that. It's crazy expensive. The United States of America during World War II took this gigantic economy and they ramped it up into warp speed, mass amounts of spending on wartime economy stuff because we were busy fighting a war on the entire globe, from the shores of Alaska to the Philippines, to Germany, to Africa. The United States of America paid for a world war. Crazy, right? Insane levels of spending. Did you know right now, because of COVID, we're spending that? And I warned you back then, I warned you. The far-reaching consequences of what we're doing to try to stop the spread of this virus, maybe they're necessary, maybe they're not, but we are talking about massive economic losses coming, and that's just the truth. We are going to be feeling this for not just, you know, the coming months, for years. No, we're not going to be in lockdown for years, but the economic impact of this is going to be, it's going to be something. Did I call that or what? And this is how it works, you see. Government creates a problem. Government decides it can spend your money, it can spend its way out of a problem, and then even once the problem is gone, they don't want to stop, you see? All this extra cheddar laying around, we got more money for him and more money for her and more money for this district and more money for this state, and I can build a new airport and I can build a new base and I can pave these roads and I can, you gave me access to all this money, all this vast amount of money in the American Treasury, and now me, member of the House, Republican and Democrat, me, Senator, Republican and Democrat, I want to take that big pot of taxpayer gold and I want to throw it out to the masses and buy myself some popularity. And oh boy, does it work. It works on a dumbed down population that doesn't understand with every $1 trillion bill, your groceries get more expensive. Let me say that again. With every $1 trillion bill, your groceries get more expensive. One more time. Every $1 trillion bill means your groceries get more expensive. Nobody really explained this problem better than Milton Friedman did.
Inflation is made in Washington because only Washington can create money. And any other attribution to other groups of inflation is wrong. Consumers don't produce it. Producers don't produce it. Trade unions don't produce it. Foreign sheiks don't produce it. Oil imports don't produce it. What produces it is too much government spending and too much government creation of money and nothing else.
What was true then remains true now. And you see, this is the problem. Americans don't understand this. And they don't understand, you see those words on the screen right now? They don't understand what's happening inside of the criminal organization known as the United States government. Senators, members of the House, and the bureaucracy, they're a huge part of this as well, and the NGOs that orbit all of these things, they are only in this to steal your money. They are in this to find out new and inventive ways to steal your money. They get to Washington, D.C., and they see this big pot of gold. It's the U.S. Treasury. It's your money. It's your money, the money you worked for, the money the government steals from you. And when all these people look at that big pot of gold, they think to themselves, I want some of that. I got to get my hands on some of that. I got to dip my hands in that. Buy myself some more political capital, hand some money out to my cousin at this NGO. I got to get some of that. And so what happens every day while you go to work and the government steals 25% plus of your income is these people go to work and they plot new and inventive ways to spend and steal your money. That's why you can't afford groceries. That's why you can't afford to remodel your house. That's why you're driving on family vacation instead of flying now. It's because the Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C. simply will not stop spending your money. They love it. They're like bank robbers who are in the bank vault and no cops are coming. It's glorious. And Trump and Elon Musk, to their credit, are finally talking about it.
Just have a government efficiency commission that takes a look at these things and just ensures that the taxpayer money, the taxpayers' hard-earned money is spent in a good way. And I'd be happy to help out on such a commission.
I'd love it
if it were formed.
Well, you're the greatest cutter. I mean, I look at what you do. You walk in and you just say, "You want to quit?" They go on strike. I won't mention the name of the company, but they go on strike, and you say, "That's okay. You're all gone."
So they're working on it. And Donald Trump has said publicly multiple times, including during his State of the Union, which I know wasn't a State of the Union, that we need to make some cuts.
Just listen to some of the appalling waste we have already identified. $22 billion from HHS to provide free housing and cars for illegal aliens. $45 million for diversity, equity, and inclusion scholarships in Burma. $40 million to improve the social and economic inclusion of sedentary migrants. Nobody knows what that is. $8 million to promote LGBTQI+ in the African nation of Lesotho, which nobody has ever heard of. $60 million for indigenous peoples and Afro-Colombian empowerment in Central America. $60 million. $8 million for making mice transgender. This is real.
I'm glad he pointed it out in front of the American people, the absurdity of it. But we have to talk about something else. Because that's an easy sell, isn't it? Only your crazy liberal Aunt Peggy, as she's popping her anti-anxiety medication, only she is supportive of those things. She's a very tiny minority. Most American people hear about transing mice and they say, probably not necessary. Okay. What about the military? Do you think there should be any cuts there? Trump thinks it should be a $1 trillion budget.
We have great things happening with our military. We also essentially approved a budget, which is in the facility. You'll like to hear this, of $1 trillion, and nobody's seen anything like it. We have to build our military, and we're very cost conscious, but the military is something that we have to build, and we have to be strong, because you got a lot of bad forces out there now. So we're going to be approving a budget, and I'm proud to say, actually, the biggest one we've ever done for the military.
The United States military is full of fraud, flat-out theft. They haven't passed an audit in years. We talk about inflation, and we need cuts, and we're going to hand a completely corrupt military $1 trillion? It's not like it's just Trump either. Listen to all these GOP senators talking about spending and cuts and inflation.
This is Biden's inflation, and he needs to own it.
Due to rampant inflation spurred by reckless government spending, and consumer prices are escalating at a historic pace.
Inflation is real. Don't dismiss it.
This is a national emergency. What I would like to do is get the administration to focus on this. There's an old expression that when you find yourself in a hole, quit digging.
President Biden's inflation is strangling a free people. The American people deserve better.
We do. How many of those senators are about to vote for a massive blowout budget that makes inflation as bad or worse? I mean, that last guy was Senator Kennedy. American people on the right, not on the left. The right loves him, absolutely loves him. I have Republican friends from Louisiana. They think he's the best. He's got so many one-liners.
I consider Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez to be the leader of the Democratic Party. She's entitled to her opinion. I'm entitled to mine. As I've said about her before, I think she's the reason there are directions on a shampoo bottle. our plan for Our plan for dealing with her is called Operation Let Her Speak.
Aha! It's funny. Gosh, the one-liners. He's even got the accent. What a straight shooter. votes for every big spending bill he can get his hands on. Sorry. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. If you want inflation to go down, we have to stop government spending. One-liners or not. We have a great show for you. Hang on. Expenses are a nightmare. Aren't they the worst? Isn't it the worst time in the world when it's expense season? I hate it in my own life. My wife will text me, do you have a receipt for this? Do you know which category does this go with? Were you at a... It's awful. How much time, how much effort, how many resources do you have to sink into it? It's a nightmare. The Ramp corporate card eliminates that nightmare. It does it all for you. It does it all for you so you can stop chasing things down. And now for a limited time, listeners of this show get $250 when you join Ramp. Go to ramp.com/Jesse. That's ramp.com/Jesse. Cards issued by Sutton Bank, member FDIC. Terms and conditions apply. Well, what is the biggest threat to the United States of America? Different people have different ideas on that. Me personally, if you asked me, I'd tell you it's the United States government, namely the FBI. But some say China. I can't say they're wrong. I wonder what Carol Ross says. Oh, here it is. Quote, the biggest threat, bar none, to U.S. growth has been and remains the U.S. government policy and U.S. government spending. And it's awfully hard to tell Carol she's wrong about that, especially given everything we're seeing today. Sorry, I'm in a sour mood about all this. Joining me now, my friend Carol Roth, author of so many great books, including the one You Will Own Nothing, which apparently you most definitely will at some point in time, given this level of government spending. Hey, Carol, why is U.S. government policy bad?
Well, I'm not going to be the one to put you in a better mood, Jesse, so apologies for that in advance. But basically, they have racked up so much debt as well as deficits that at this point are wartime level deficits at a time when we're supposed to be having quote unquote growth, that it's put us in a really terrible fiscal position. We have a balance sheet that looks like that of an emerging market about to have a sovereign debt crisis. The only reason it hasn't happened so far is that we're the world reserve currency, but certainly many countries are trying to move away from that. As I said, we have these crazy deficit levels. And at the end of the day, we put ourselves into a position where we're now spending more to service the interest on our debt than we are for defense spending. So it's difficult for us to be a strong country and have the cards and make the deals that we want to when we have this really terrible fiscal position. And it's created lots of issues and choices and trade-offs, all of which end up, you know, in the end, screwing the American consumer.
Carol, describe this sovereign debt crisis, because as you said, we've been able to avoid, well, we've been able to rack up this amount of debt, spend at this level, because we are the world's reserve currency. When you're trading your goods and services, you can always rely on the U.S. dollar, of course. But what does a debt crisis look like if they decide they're done with all that and they're going to go to something like gold?
Well, I think that the first thing that probably happens is we get a dysfunction in the treasury markets where everything go crazy and you start to see rates spiking. And the most likely thing that's going to happen is that the Fed and the government aren't going to want to go immediately into a crisis. So they're going to do what they need to do to stop the bleeding. And what does that usually look like? Well, that usually looks like something we saw quantitative easing with the Fed buying lots of securities, a certain amount of securities to keep down interest rates and to help the situation out because there are no other buyers for the debt. But it could come in a different package. There's something called yield curve control, which is a kind of the same thing. But instead of having a defined program like QE, where they say we're going to buy a $1 trillion worth of bonds, they say we're going to buy whatever it takes in order to keep the yield below a certain amount, or something that approximates that under some other special pretty packaging. And as we've seen before, what does that do? It ends up transferring wealth to the asset holders. It ends up creating inflation for, you know, the everyday consumer. It drives non-merit-based inequality. And that continues on until, you know, everybody says, okay, this is crazy, and we need to have some other sort of ordering of our financial order.
Carol, one thing that drives me so insane about this whole thing, it makes me want to choke somebody, is how obvious and inevitable all this is. It's not a left or right or conservative or Democrat or libertarian. It's simple math. You can't run up these numbers. It's obvious. Even the morons in Washington, D.C. know what you say is true, yet no one wants to stop it. Even the American voter, honestly, yeah, they want to stop transing mice, but they don't want to actually make significant government cuts to anything. And that's why we are where we are.
Yeah, well, the challenge is that they want to do it at the macro level, that way they know we need to stop spending. But when it comes down to the micro level and it threatens their own, you know, specific pet project or the dollars that they are getting personally, then it becomes personal and it needs to shift. And this is just basic human nature, which is why this is, as you said, all very predictable. And the larger the government gets, the more likely this is to happen. So that's really what we're up against. Even with spending cuts, though, Jesse, we have to do this in a way that's very careful. Because we have the debt to GDP that we do and the deficit to GDP, part of the issue that we have is that we've been taking in very large amounts of revenue, and that's been based on government spending propping up our GDP and generating some additional revenue. It's been propping up our stock market and generating revenue from that. If that stops, if we cut spending too fast, as you and I have discussed before, what could end up happening is that we get a decrease in revenue, and these are the government, quote unquote, revenue, the tax revenue. And we saw that back in, I think it was the third quarter of 2022. If we get a recession, if we have prolonged dips in the stock market, we're talking, it could be a half $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion or more that we're no longer taking in, and it really ends up exploding that deficit. That's what's happened, you know, before when we've seen the stock market go down as well as in previous recessions. So, you know, you don't want to be in a no good deed goes unpunished situation either. So they have to be very careful in how they phase out that financing, at the same time finding ways to amplify growth, you know, so that you get that kick up in the GDP. Because if you do it in a way that brings down the GDP, then again, we end up in this vicious cycle, which takes us back into that potential for a debt spiral.
Carol, how does China come into play here? Obviously, they're going to be a player of some kind because globally, you can't ignore them. How does China, our policy with China, how does it affect any of this?
Oh, it affects all kinds of things, including the fact that the Chinese own all kinds of assets, including treasuries, the stock market and whatnot. So, you know, for the amount of leverage that we think we have over China, they also have leverage on the other side. And if we get into a match with them, because, you know, they think in hundreds of years, and we have a new president, you know, every 4 or 8 years, as well as a shift over of Congress every 2 years. So, you know, it's very difficult to have a long-term strategy. And so they're able to wait out, you know, dips and shifts and changes in a different way than we are. So I would imagine, to the extent that we cannot get China to come to the table and do something side by side, that's actually very bad for us. And I know we all hate China and we all, you know, understand the issues with communism and whatnot, but this is the situation that we're in now. And to our own benefit, we need to be able to find a way to figure out where their points are, where we meet in the middle, and be able to extract ourselves and build up the capabilities and, you know, right our financial ship and do all of these things first before we can fully cut them off, because otherwise it's going to end up being to our own detriment. And as you know, I wrote about in You Own Nothing, it could actually end up in war. And when you've had previous massive changes in the global financial order before, it's always been preceded by war. So this is a very tenuous situation. The Biden administration left the Trump administration a mess. They don't have a lot of options here. And that's why, you know, we're seeing as they're trying to do things that it's been pretty painful.
When goods stop crossing borders, armies will. That's an old saying. I don't know who said it, but I'll take credit for it. I guess I said it. Well, I'm going to let you go now, Carol. Goodbye. Thank you. I'm so sad. We just can't stop spending. Can't stop doing it. American people love it. Politicians don't have the guts to stop it. Something else. Whatever. Let's talk about China. In fact, forget China. Let's talk about COVID and what it did to bring about all this with Jeffrey Tucker next. I love my cell phone company. I love patronizing companies that are America first. Hiring Americans shouldn't be like a secondary issue anymore. And for the longest time, I didn't pay attention to that in my youth. I wish I had. It matters. It matters. Companies that focus on hiring Americans, creating American jobs. Pure Talk, they're on the same 5G network. So when you have, you know, the big guys, AT&T and those guys, don't think that you're getting better service than I do. Pure Talk will let you keep your phone or give you a new phone if you want it. You keep your phone number or a new one if you're trying to hide from your ex-wife. Pure Talk will save you a fortune for the same service, only you get to support an American company for less money. Why wouldn't you switch? PureTalk.com/JesseTV allows you the freedom to support an American company for less money. PureTalk.com/JesseTV.
We're announcing new guidelines for every American to follow over the next 15 days as we combat the virus. Each and every one of us has a critical role to play in stopping the spread and transmission of the virus. We did this today. This was done by a lot of very talented people, some of whom are standing with me.
I remember that day like it was yesterday. I don't know that I've ever been that frustrated in my life, but I remember it like it was yesterday, shutting down a $20 trillion economy for a virus. Joining me now, Jeffrey A. Tucker, founder and president of the Brownstone Institute. Jeffrey, I understand why it's not popular to bring up old things like that, even though it was 5 years ago, but the truth is that was the beginning of so much destruction, so much inflation, so much that we still feel to this day. The very idea that you shut down a country on purpose for a virus, it's an idea so insane that I can't believe so many people bought it and everyone on the planet bought it.
We've now published about 15, maybe 17, maybe 20 books on the topic. We have a new one coming out, which is a compilation on all of our research. We haven't even begun to get to the bottom of exactly what happened in those days. I'm obsessed with the topic myself, digging up every bit of information. Trump knows, a lot of people know. Navarro knows, there's a lot of people who know, but very few people are willing to actually speak about it. A lot of what's happening right now with the Trump administration traces to those days. They just went after the head of the guy named who was head of CISA, which is the cyber infrastructure security, whatever, cybersecurity infrastructure security agency that was in effect the government of 2020. They were in charge of censorship, they were in charge of election security, and they were the first agency that went out there to divide the workforce between essential and unessential. So basically the government, right? It was a small department within Department of Homeland Security, and they assumed the role of essentially running the country, if not the world. And Trump put out an executive order basically attacking the guy who was head of the agency at the time. So, which tells me that Trump knows exactly, you know, who was at fault. I'm not sure if he knows exactly, but he has an intuition that there was profound things going on at that time that resulted in his, you know, and a very compromised election. But the story is much bigger than that, as you and I both know, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of it. And yes, it was contrary to the Constitution. It was contrary to all moral intuition. It was contrary to epidemiology and economics and all good sense. It was our first introduction to the meaning and fullness of totalitarian government. That's what happened.
No, it was. I remember it like yesterday, standing on the footprints in the grocery store, taking down the outdoor basketball hoops. It was almost as if we have a legion of tyrants in power in this country, and they were waiting for such a day where they could finally take the throne and be the kings and queens they wanted to be. That's what it felt like. It's what it still feels like when I look back on it. I don't know how you can interpret it any other way, frankly.
It was quasi-martial law. We felt it at the time. We were obeying things that weren't actually legislation. We were obeying things that weren't actually laws. We didn't know who was in charge of anything and what the consequences for defiance would be. It was just all vague and strange, and our voices were throttled very quickly, right? I mean, even from middle of March, and certainly by a month later, the censorship was full-blown, so we felt, those of us who thought the world was going crazy, we felt very much alone. A lot of our ideological colleagues in the past, if you move in those circles, completely abandoned the cause. They stayed entirely silent, and it went on and on and on, and nobody could really figure out why. Then we had this weird summer 2020 thing where all the cultural and government prevailing government elite said, okay, now you have to leave your home to go protest the murder of George Floyd. You remember that? And so suddenly all the young people are out in the streets going, yeah, I'm against racism. And then, you know, cities, you know, whole cities burned down and that sort of thing. And then, I don't know, it's like only weeks later, it was back, go back home again. Now it's time to hide from the virus again. And this went on and on and on. And finally, by October, we managed to put together the Great Barrington Declaration, which cut through all the censors and caused panic inside NIH and many other institutions in Washington. And I couldn't even understand entirely why. Looking back now, it's incredibly obvious why the Great Barrington Declaration panicked the people in charge. Because it said very plainly and in accordance with all of history that the problem would end with exposure and natural immunity. It all, even added assisted by vaccines. But that was exactly the problem. The idea that we could just get through this by being a normal society was what panicked the elites, because let's put it frankly, it took me like 2 years to realize this, they had a product to sell, and that product was a shot. And they were very concerned that the Great Barrington Declaration would diminish consumer uptake, and that's why they wanted to suppress it. That's why they censored it. And then when the shot was released after the election, right? The election that was heavily compromised by mail-in ballots that were mandated by the CDC back in March, and even funded by the CDC back in March. So Trump lost because of those mail-in ballots. Then, and only then, was the vaccine released. It was deliberately delayed until after the election. But uptake was, in fact, quite low, as they realized by, several months later. And that's when the mandate started. So millions of people eventually were displaced from their jobs, fired, including tenured professors, frontline healthcare workers, anybody who didn't accept the shot, pilots and, you know, all sorts of things. Anybody who didn't accept the shot was threatened with their jobs, fired, and the whole nation went into upheaval. But even that didn't work because uptake was still lower than they wanted. They were going for something like 90%. So then came the mask mandates. It's like, okay, you're not going to get the shot. Well, now you have to cover your face everywhere. And even though that we all existing research said the masks do not stop the spread of a respiratory virus with a zoonotic reservoir, we knew this. They were useless, but suddenly the mask mandates were everywhere. And that went on for another 6 or 8 months. During this period, too, whole cities were shut down. I mean, nobody talks about this. Nobody's like, it's like this history has just vanished. But there were at least five cities that closed all public accommodations to the unvaccinated. There were New York and Boston and New Orleans and Seattle and Chicago. Those are the ones we know about. And it was intended to be nationwide. There was such outrage about this that they finally had to roll these things back. But it seems just incredible to think we actually segregated our cities in the United States along lines that had a fantastically racially disproportionate impact on all these cities, so that the minority populations, which tended to refuse the vaccine at a greater rate than majority populations, were actually not allowed into theaters, libraries, and restaurants and bars. So this actually happened in this country. So yeah, I want to get to the bottom of it.
It's unbelievable. And Jeffrey, honestly, the point of this whole special tonight is how the government just started spending crazily and haven't stopped a thing, have not cut back on a single solitary penny. They got a new injection of drugs, and I'm not convinced they ever will. I'm convinced we will maintain COVID levels of spending until economic collapse.
Yeah, I just looked at the latest thing just passed by the House Republicans. It doesn't really cut a dime. It promises to cut in the future, as it always has. Friend Thomas Massie voted against it and got attacked for doing so. But yeah, they're, despite all the efforts of DOGE, despite all the promises, they're still not cutting the spending. All that was accommodated, all that new spending during the COVID period was accommodated by money printing, which led to anywhere between 25%, 35%, 40% decline in overall purchasing power of the dollar during the Biden years. So our standard of living has diminished. The government has grown. The powers are not really taken away. I mean, Trump's done some things, something like a beginning of change, and I thrill every day to see the executive orders and the changes enacted by the redirection of funding away from the left, and so on. That's quite delightful. But we are nowhere near getting to the bottom line in terms of the truth of that period and what happened, or having any kind of serious discussion about it. I would like to mention very quickly that my friends actually made major efforts to get the DOD to confess what was going on at the military Olympics in October in Wuhan. And the DOD just yesterday, this would have been, say April 8th, April 9th, finally came out with a report 5 months late, but they finally came out with a report admitting that, yes, seven soldiers, got sick with COVID-19-like symptoms, get this, between October and they dated it very late in January 2020. So, I mean, that the report is, the very embodiment of the limited hangout, if you can imagine. So it raises more questions than it answers.
Of course it does. Jeffrey, you were the best. Come back again, sir. All right. We're almost done. Hang on. I love to sleep. I love it. And there's just something, look, I'm a big believer in kind of starting out on the right foot, if you will, in business meetings. That's why you shake hands, look them in the eye. When you're picking up your honey for a date, oh, you look pretty, not, hey, did you get the dishes done? It's setting the tone, I guess I should say. When you have a good night's sleep, you wake up in the morning, it sets the tone for your entire day. If you slept great, you know it immediately. When you wake up, you can tell how you feel, you're ready. And when you didn't sleep, you know today's gonna suck. Dream powder from Beam will have you sleeping like a baby every single night. Did you know that? Up to 40% off at shopbeam.com/JesseKelly. It's a cup of hot chocolate that'll put you to sleep. Go now.
We are restoring the name of a great president, William McKinley, to Mount McKinley in Alaska. He was the big tariff sheriff, they used to call him, and made a lot of money. Our country became very rich, and when he was assassinated, Teddy Roosevelt became president, and he spent all of that money that was made from tariffs. The money was so enormous, and they built the thing called the Panama Canal.
You don't hear many people reference McKinley. Killed by an anarchist, shot in the stomach. Even though he was very fat, it ended up killing him. Joining me now, David Keene, editor-at-large, Washington Times. David, not many people bring up McKinley. Shoot, you don't ever hear his name. You do hear Teddy Roosevelt's name, but people forget about our different economic policies back then.
Well, back then, prior to Wilson, the tariffs were used as the major way of raising revenues for the government. That changed at the beginning of the 20th century. But there's no question that during that period, tariffs were, as Trump likes to look at them, as a main source of revenue, as well as a source of protectionism. You remember back in the 18th century and the 19th century, the newly formed United States was what we could today call a developing country. And oftentimes developing countries protect their infant industries with tariff walls as those industries develop and mature. And that's what was going on at that time.
Okay, so are we past that phase now? At what point in time does a country move past that phase?
Well, we're certainly past the stage of a developing country, although you could argue that much of our industry is in decline just for age reasons. Because, for example, one of the things the president's been talking about in recent days is the problem we have with the maritime trades, with building and equipping ships, where China is outstripping us by 1,000 ships a year. One of the reasons for that, from an economic standpoint, is that a nation's competitiveness in that depends almost entirely on how new its shipbuilding facilities are. So that, for example, our shipyards, which in many cases are 100 years old or more, are competing against shipyards that are 10 or 15 years old. And the technology, just as an example, we talk about wages, but I know when I looked some years ago at building a ship in Korea versus building it in the United States, the problem was it took 3 to 4 times as many man hours to build it in the United States as it did in Korea, because we were using antiquated methods, and we still are. So many of these industries have sort of sat on their laurels, if you will, and have not increased or kept up with the competitiveness of the rest of the world. So in that sense, much of the American manufacturing infrastructure in particular is behind the times. So that's true. The other problem is that there's been a general acceptance in the course of the 20th and 21st century of the macro advantages of free trade, there has never really been a situation in which free trade exists, so that you've got countries imposing tariffs on other countries while those countries, in this case the United States, lets that go on and suffers losses as a result of those tariff walls. One of the problems that on the trade front that the president confronts is that with these tariffs that he suggested, in today's world, many of the walls that have been put up aren't tariff walls. They're regulatory walls. They're workarounds that other countries have developed. They're things that are hard to quantify, but which in fact make it impossible or very difficult for Americans to compete. In Europe, of course, you've got in the agricultural field, where basically Europe subsidizes its entire agricultural thing, not through tariffs, but through bans on the kinds of products that come from the United States. So it's a very difficult thing to achieve what politicians used to call free and fair trade. And it's fair trade, I think, that the president and the current administration is seeking. And that requires you to look at things as they are rather than as you might like them to be.
No doubt. David, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining us. All right. I have final thoughts. Next. Look, I know this is difficult to hear, but all we can do is recognize the problem and start to tackle the problem. And look, it's like somebody who's extremely fat. Maybe that's you. Maybe you're super fat and you want to lose the weight. We want it easy, don't we? Can I just get a shot of something? Can I just go to the doctor? But the truth is, it's going to involve sacrifices. It's going to involve giving up things you want. You want to lose the weight. You don't have to give up soda. You have to go for a walk on Saturday morning. You have to skip a pizza. You're going to have to... It's going to involve denying yourself things you've grown accustomed to. The United States of America, if we want to save our economic system long term, we are going to have to make major adjustments to things we've grown accustomed to. There's no other way to do it. And all we can do, look, with all these big problems, all we can do is start now and start voting that way and start demanding it from our reps. All right? All right. We'll do it again.
This is an iHeart podcast.